Welcome to the Fat Thor Podcast. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm your host, Andy Gunnan, and with me today, your co-host, Jody Cuttad, as always.
We got What's up, sir?
What's up, buddy? We got a great show today. We got a great podcast. We have a guest in the house. I'm going to introduce him just a little bit. We'll get this party started. If you know anything about satire, this man created The Onion, which is a satire news webpage has been around, gosh, over 30 years now. He's a stand-up comedian, writer, author. He's written books about how to write in comedy and a bunch of other things. It's just credits a mile long. So let's just introduce Scott Diggers. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you very much for having me, everybody. It's great to be here.
Great to have you, brother.
Great.
It's you know what this is? It's like morning drive time radio. This is what this is. Like we're goofing around. We got a party. I expect you guys to have fart sound effects at the ready.
Right. Is that gonna happen? No, I don't have those. I don't have those, but I do. It's weird. I do host my podcast like I host my radio show. It's just like I can't shut it off when I get a microphone in front of me to do a pod.
Was it unplugged?
Yeah, it's a party, and it'll wake people up.
Right, exactly. Especially 11 o'clock Eastern.
If you're not awake yet, this will do it.
Exactly. That's the whole point. I've had a lot going on. Jody's had a lot going on. Scott, welcome to the show. Look, we're just going to jump into it, man. You've created a great platform, which is The Onion Political. It's a satire news publication.
For your listeners, I describe it as the Babylon Bee for liberals.
The Babylon Bee for liberals. That's a very good description.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask this.
It's hard to believe, but I did. I did. It was a long time ago, and it really is unreal how big it's gotten. It's like a household name. Everybody knows it. And that's strange. You know, it's a strange feeling.
Well, it's been around for so long. And, you know, I remember when it came out, and I jumped on, and I was like, this is great. It was very early. It was in the early 90s.
Now, where were you at that time in the country?
I was still here in Georgia.
Okay.
I was in Georgia. I was selling building material. I was still in a sales career, not in trying to be in an entertainment career. So being at my desk and working on Excel sheets and stuff and being able to pull up stuff that was real and read stuff other than a newspaper was really, really refreshing.
Yes. We went online, I think, in 95. So that would have been, people started discovering us. And we had been in print like 7 years prior to that. So a lot of people thought it was like, oh my God, who are these people? But we had been doing it and we're sort of comfortable doing it. So the internet came along at just the right time for us to just kind of expand our readership. We were distributed pretty much exclusively on the campus of the University of Wisconsin in Madison prior to the internet. And then suddenly our audience increases by a factor of a billion.
That's insane.
Wow.
It's very insane. Yeah, it was wild.
Especially for then and that time.
Yeah.
That was all new territory of what is viral and before viral was viral.
Unheard of. Viral then was emails that would get passed around. Do you remember those? People would copy in stories and they would email them to each other with no attribution. And we would get so upset. Like, we're trying to grow this thing. We're trying to get out there. And people would just steal it, take off our name, and it would become viral on email. And one of the things that actually sort of nudged us into getting closer to being a household name was the guys on Car Talk, the NPR show, got one of those viral emails and read the entire story verbatim and just were cracking up the whole time. And meanwhile, we're listening and just like crying because this, what a beautiful moment to get publicity, and they're not crediting us at all. So we called them and told them who we were. And then on the next show, they spent like 20 minutes like buttering us up one side and down the other. And that felt pretty awesome. It was one of our first like brushes with fame, I guess, or publicity, you know.
Nice. That's awesome. That's awesome. Let me ask this, because The Onion now is still going. It's still out there. You've been in and out with The Onion. You kind of you pull out, you do some writing, you've come back. Are you still involved as of right now currently with The Onion, or are you stepped out again?
The only thing I do is I teach these writing courses. I started this training center at the Second City. Now I do it on my own. And a lot of my students end up getting jobs there. So like The Onion and also Clickhole is filled with my students. And so that's my only involvement, really. I'm not part of the company, not part of the day-to-day. And I don't think I'm going back. You're right. I used to leave and come back. I would go on hiatus. I would think I would leave. I would think it would be, okay, I'm done. I've done what I can. And then for whatever reason, they would invite me back. The situation was such that they wanted an infusion of some of the original vision or whatever. I don't see that happening again. I'm pretty sure I'm out for good now, which is fine.
Retired.
It's like when you have a kid, it's like the kid might need some help when they're 16, 18, maybe early 20s. The Onion's 35 years old now. It would be pathetic if The Onion came groveling to me for help. You know,
<Yeah.
laughs> it's doing fine. And I'm proud of it.
Yeah, 35 years is a long stretch in this world that of the virtual world now, because things come and go so much, especially from the 90s to now. A lot of things disappeared, went away. Some of the things that we forgot about, you know, you go, oh, what happened to that? You know, it's like it just vanished.
Yeah, well, like you said, to stay relevant that long of a period
is shocking.
And our virtual world now it's crazy.
You know, to think that the Arsenio Hall show was contemporary with The Onion, now nobody remembers that show. I think it helps that The Onion does current events. So every time it comes out, it's about what's going on. So that news parody format has been really helpful. It was helpful in other ways to begin with, because when you're a comedy writer and you want to do funny stuff, it actually helps to have that narrow format, because it helps you focus and it gives you kind of a structure. Things like the National Lampoon always kind of worried me, because it was just a wide open. You could do anything, write an article about anything. It could be a parody of a different type of book. It could be just a magazine article. And there was no like parameters for the creativity. That's tough for a creative person.
Right. You know, and that's, you know, that's where we're getting into. You are now teaching, like you said, you're basically cultivating employees for them. You teach writing, you teach comedy.
I'm like coach of the farm team is what I am. Yeah.
But you've also written a lot of books on how to write funny, funniest and funnier, if I remember correctly, all three.
And the fourth one is how to write funny characters. Yeah. So that's been fun. Those books actually led to the teaching, because I left The Onion and I had all this knowledge in my head. I thought I had gotten really good at how to write comedy, how to write jokes so you know they're going to work. And I noticed in other comedians and comedy professionals, we all kind of knew the same stuff. Like, what are the basic components of a joke? What makes it a professional joke? What gives it a better chance of succeeding versus any random funny thing someone might say off the cuff? You know, because professional comedians have to have an above average batting average, or otherwise, why are they in the business? But nobody had ever written that stuff down. Nobody had ever spelled it out, how you do it. And that always bothered me. Comedy was one of these things that was totally secret. They say a magician never reveals its tricks, but that's total bunk. Magicians make magic trick books you can buy, and they'll tell you exactly how to do the trick, and they have kits. There's no comedian kit. And I wanted one growing up. I really wanted that. I got Steve Allen's book, How to Be Funny, and it was just awful. It was just him pontificating about comedy. It wasn't any how-to anything. And so I decided to write it down. I had only done humor books up to that point. So it was my first nonfiction, like how-to book. And that's the other thing that always bothered me about books on comedy. They always try to be funny. And I don't want that. If I'm learning comedy, just tell me how to do the comedy. Don't try to do the jokes, you know? That's annoying. So yeah, put out that book and didn't really think much of it. I self-published it on Amazon and just kind of didn't tell anybody. And it just sort of like snowballed over time and people discovered it. And then I did this partnership with the Second City to develop these courses. And now there's this how to write funny website. It has a whole community of people, former students and other writers. I give away a lot of free stuff on the website and stuff. There are paid courses, but I try to give back. You know, the comedy industry has been really good to me, and I just want to help other comedians go through that journey faster and be more successful at it. So that's my game with that.
Right. And in this day and age, everybody wants everything now. They want to know how, you know, they don't want to spend the time or the process, and they may not have the 20 years to devote and put into it at this point. Like myself, I mean, I started way late into the comedy and entertainment world, even though I wanted to, you know, so yeah, you've got to figure that structure and those things out. And I've noticed a few things that on the flip side, I don't know if you noticed, is that it's not about writing so much as it is when you are a new comedian or new comedians coming in or that have been in. I've noticed the big gap I see is being able to be an entrepreneur and how to run yourself as a business solo and not having a safety net of a paycheck and network and things. That's the big gap I see with a lot of really funny, good comedians and writers. They just don't have this business or and the entrepreneurial part being out there in the scoreboard zero area scares the hell out of them.
Yeah, you nailed it. And that was the first course I made online was called Comedy Business School, you know, because when you do comedy, you basically, especially if you're a stand-up comic, you have to have three skills. You have to be a joke writer, and you have to be a performer. You have to know how to perform and have confidence on stage. And thirdly, you have to be a businessman. Like you said, you have to know how to leverage your work to actually get paid. Because if you're just going and doing stand-up, it's really tough to make a living at that. You have to have ancillary things, and you have to think about your career and, you know, what are other things you can do that'll help your stand-up? You know, could you publish articles? Could you write jokes for other people? Could you work on the radio? Could you do voice work? Could you write a book? You know, comedians should always write a book, put their face on the cover. It's like such a great branding tool to get your persona out there. You can sell it at shows, and it puts you on the radar in the audience's mind as someone of consequence, like a comedian of consequence. And that sort of thinking, like thinking of yourself as a brand and not just a voice or a persona. I see a lot of comedians, you know, leaving money on the table and just not taking advantage of some of that stuff. I think a lot of people are daunted by it. Again, why I did the course, I wanted to kind of simplify that process. Merch, you know, everybody should be doing merch. It doesn't have to be scary, you know, you can always get help. You can always delegate that stuff, but it's good to know the basics so you can like start setting it up yourself.
All right. Yeah. I mean, you've got to start anything you do at the base, but nobody wants to start at the basis of anything anymore. Cause we just want to be able to flip on the YouTube and we watch a video. We know what to do, right?
This abandonment of patience has been a big problem in a lot of areas. Yes. And a lot of things just take time, you know, and I think also people are afraid to start imperfect. They're afraid to start good, not perfect, which is so important. You know, just put yourself out there. Don't worry about sucking. Don't worry about looking bad. You know, if you look at any comedian or anyone in show business that you like and trust, look at their earliest work and you'll see that it wasn't that great, but they boldly put themselves out there because they had to. They had a drive to do this thing. And if you have that drive, that's what you have to do. And nobody cares about the older stuff. Nobody's going to scroll all the way down to your TikTok account to look at your first four videos and how lame they were. People, and if somebody is doing that, God bless them. They're like a super fan, and they're going to love you anyway.
Right? They're just helping your algorithm.
Yeah.
Jody had that happen. Jody's got canceled.
What happened?
We violated a bunch of policies. I don't know even what policies they were.
On TikTok, you're talking about?
On TikTok, yeah. Yep.
Easy to get banned on TikTok. The algorithm is pretty brutal.
Yes.
It's Chinese authoritarianism is what it is.
It is. And he doesn't know. He doesn't do anything bad. He's totally clean. He's totally clean about everything. It's just like,
yeah. There's no telling.
They just don't like midgets.
Yeah. Well, I think you know, a lot of women who look young get banned because they think they're underage.
Yeah.
That happens a lot.
Not some of the stuff I've seen pop up. I'm like, what the heck is? It's like,
you gotta wonder.
I'm just here for comedy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just here for comedy and stuff.
It's a great platform. I do like TikTok.
Well, and we've talked about it here on the podcast, and I'm not against anything that helps promote something very positive in a good light. Like, there's been a lot of comedians that have come out of it. I think that the light's been shown on them globally, nationally, that were features that now are headlining and deserve that because they're very talented. And we just lost Scott. Hopefully he'll come back in.
Well, it goes back to the whole opportunity thing. I mean, you've got to take that opportunity and shoot.
Oh, sorry about that. I got cut out there.
No worries.
You were saying there's some comedians on TikTok who have like blown up.
Yes, you know, and it's able to put a light on them more than what Facebook did for them or YouTube or whatever. It's just another channel to plug into that got them to the next step or next level.
Yeah, and because it's a new platform, it's easier to grow on it. It's easier to grow faster. And the way they do their algorithm, I don't know what it is about it. It just makes it so much easier to go viral. Like, what a great thing for comedy, you know?
Oh, yeah, exactly. And that's the way, you know, that's what I've looked at as it's a tool in your toolbox to be. And that's the thing now. And, you know, to get booked on a lot of stuff or into some of these festivals, you've got to have a following X amount or they won't even look at you, which is totally, in my opinion, BS. But I understand it's the day we live in, you know, because there's a lot of funny guys out there that I'm like that don't have that following. They're not getting in. And I'm not talking about myself. I'm just talking in general.
Yeah, it's sad. Again, kind of leaving money on the table. There's this guy, Scott Seiss, I think how you pronounce his name. He's had a few viral videos about being a minimum wage employee and just killing it on TikTok. He's got like 1.5 to 2 million followers. And like you said, like he's out there headlining, you know? So it really, any tool you can use, like you never know where the boost is going to come from. So you got to kind of be everywhere. And also you want to be on the new stuff. So any new platform comes up, I always try to keep my eyes open. You don't want to be late to one of these things because if you're early, it's going to be a much easier path for you to get big fast, you know?
Well, you basically created a brand and name. So you're going to have to put that on everything.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. You gotta. And then, it does become a burden to like have to post to all these platforms.
Yes.
You know, there's tools for that too. There's tools that can, you know, cross post and, it's just part of the job. You know, it's like another thing I hear, you know, you hear this from people a lot is that, I don't like doing that stuff. I don't like social media or whatever. And that's like a farmer getting up in the morning and saying, I just don't like milking cows. You know, it's just not my thing, you know?
Right.
It's part of the job. It's part of the work that you have to do.
Yeah.
And every job has its dishwashing or its cow milking part. And you just got to do it.
Exactly. And you're right. It gets exhausting. And you're like, cause it becomes a full-time job. It's like me and Jody were talking about when he took off and went to 2 million followers and we were sitting and we've been over the last several weeks and we've been talking about it on the podcast and kind of following this trend and how it's doing and what's going on and kind of, you know, letting people watch and follow this whole path of, here's what he did. Here's how and how I grabbed on and caught on. And because we're all learning as we're going along with this thing, because in different arenas. And it's been absolutely very intriguing and funny and scary from, oh, we got 2 million. Now you're no more.
Yeah. I mean, when you got 100,000, it's easy to keep up with. Once it gets over 100,000, it's a full-time job. I mean, it literally is.
How do you keep up with that? It's like an onslaught. Like I've had a couple of TikTok videos go mini viral. You know, I just got on a few weeks ago. I was a little late to it, But I've had a couple of videos go pretty viral, and it's hard to just, I like to be able to at least heart all the likes, but that became like every few hours I was logging on, there's like hundreds more people, and I have to like, you know, it's tough.
I can post a video and within a minute, there's like 20,000 likes.
That's crazy.
You can't keep up with it.
No, you can't. You can't. You just got to keep posting and, you know, hope people don't feel completely alienated from you who like you, you know?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I've heard, and I kind of took on those things. Like, you know, I've heard a couple of comedians just say, hey, post your stuff and just walk away from it and let it do its thing and just come back to it later. Cause you still got to write, still got to do other things, still got a house to keep, you still got a marriage to try to keep together, relationships. So it's like, turn off, and don't get sucked into the negative stuff. Just, you know, a couple positive ones and then just turn it off and walk away. Because if not, you'll never get anything done.
Yeah, you can't do that. And then the worst thing is to get actually sucked into the doom scrolling. Like if you're actually becoming an audience of TikTok instead of a creator, you're doomed. That's you're going right to Mordor there with that.
Right, exactly. but it's interesting. It's fun to watch. It's very, but it, again, it's one of those tools you have to have and you have to do no matter what, you know. And especially I like the comedy lately. It's like everybody's like, oh, you got to start comedy in your 20s. Like, look, I started in my 40s, Jack, you know, so I'm a little later to the party.
I don't think it matters. I think people just want funny. I don't think they care about your age or your gender, your race or anything. I don't think they care a whit.
No, they don't. But the one thing I've seen more, especially here in the South, and I'm kind of seeing a little bit all over and throughout, is like people are wanting more cleaner comics, clean comedy.
Yeah.
And that's been the big strife. And that's kind of where I hit the nail on the head here in Atlanta, is staying clean to help get me more stage time a lot quicker and sooner. And a lot of guys now are trying to reverse who have not been clean and go make their stuff cleaner. And that's the new trend I've seen kind of in the last couple of years.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've seen that too. And there's the biggest and best club here in Minneapolis is clean only, you know, so that's kind of the culture here. And it does open more doors but it's harder, you know, it's harder to be clean because you're losing one of the tools. I will couch that though. I think like the shock funny filter is one of the tools you have as a comedy writer, and you can go all out with it and use swearing and, you know, shocking subject matter, but there's a version of shock that's clean. You know, you can just do slightly shocking things like PG rated shock, and it still works as shock humor and it still gives you that other tool. But you just don't have to go all the way with it.
Right. So when you're teaching your students in your classes and things like that, is that you just say, hey, do whatever makes you feel comfortable or whatever they want to do, and just kind of guide them that way. What is your philosophy in that and teaching that?
Yeah, I'm all about the original voice. So what's your voice? What's your persona? And I try to teach the fundamentals of like what makes jokes work. But ultimately, it's about the individual voice, because that's the original thing that no one else can duplicate. So if you're out there practicing that, honing that, figuring out what that voice is, and you have these fundamental tools to know how to turn your opinions into great material, you know, the world's your oyster. You just got to keep working at it and you'll get there.
Exactly.
Find your niche.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it may be today, it may go viral. And see, that's the thing that's always kind of intrigued me, is like, you know, I've always like, if I'm going to grow in this thing, I want to grow slow so I develop, so I don't get the cart before the horse. But today you can get so fast, so viral. Like Jody was saying, it went so fast up under him. He's been trying to like kind of run to keep up with the ball, so to speak. And the ball's trying to get out in front of him versus what he was kind of, I'm just doing this. You know, I'm just kind of here and there.
Yeah. It's almost like the prime directive. It's like, you don't want to hurl fame at someone too soon, cause they're just not ready for it. And, you know, you see the pitfalls, you see people who get famous too young, too fast, and they turn into divas or whatever, can be really dangerous. The people who do go the slow and steady are seasoned by the time it happens, and they know how to manage it. I don't know, though. Fame is sort of so much a part of the culture now that it didn't used to be because of social media. Like, everybody has access to fame. It seems like there's a little more fame literacy now, like how you're supposed to be famous, how you're supposed to act, how you're supposed to conduct yourself so you're not a dick, you know. I think it's I think that's a good trend in general.
Yeah.
I have a rule. It's the WWHD rule. What would Tom Hanks do? Because he's, except for recently he blew up at a fan. That was a really scary thing to see. My world shook. But
I'm a huge Tom Hanks fan myself.
He is great at being famous. He knows part of the job is he'll never eat at a restaurant in peace. If he sees somebody, he has to make that interaction the most delightful interaction that person will ever have with another person. So he'll take pictures with you. He'll be your best buddy because he knows that's part of his asset, is that people are going to be traveling around the world saying, oh yeah, I met Tom Hanks once. Best guy in the world, you know, greatest guy in the world. But if you're a jerk and you're mean to a couple of people, that gets around, you know?
Yeah.
So it's important.
Yes. It's the old adage, you know, bad review, you know, three people will talk about it. A good review, one person will talk about it.
Absolutely.
But then sometimes, but like what we've talked about here, it's good to have haters because haters will push you out there, especially on social media.
You know, I'll take it. Like any promotion, any publicity is good publicity to a point. But yeah, you're right. What you said before, like I would never like engage with a hater. Just let him be. My little rule of thumb is, if you have a hater, that there's a law of the universe that means that you have 50 fans. For every 50 fans you get, you're going to get one hater. And so every hater, I did this reframing exercise, like It's a Wonderful Life, where he kisses the banister at the end, on the stairwell. I turn haters into a positive. It's like every time you hear a hater, an angel gets his wings. So every time you see a hater, that means you got 50 new fans, you know?
Yeah.
Well, it's all on how you yourself take it, you know?
Yeah, they may not be as loud, but that hater represents 50 new fans, and that's good.
Exactly. Well, Howard Stern built a career off of people hating him. Built a massive career, radio career and everything else.
He's got new haters now. It's amazing.
He's figured out how to flip and go to the other side and make all the other people on the other side that used to love him hate him.
Amazing.
It's absolutely amazing. It's crazy. Let me ask you this, Scott, kind of go back to the writing a little bit, and then we'll kind of move on to some other things. What's your process in writing these days? And what, I mean, obviously you're definitely write different than you used to, probably in different ways, but what do you do? What's your process?
I actually don't write that much differently than I used to. It all comes down to me for all the, you know, skills and the best practices and everything. It really comes down to looking at a blank sheet of paper and putting something on it. And that's always worked for me. I guess more lately I'm doing the record a voice memo type of writing, but that's always just a germ that I then will sit down and write out. So my best practice is I try to write 10 funny things a day. I think that really helps just to keep the muscle in shape. And it also like accumulates, and you know, that's 70 ideas a week. It's like, you know, 3,650 ideas a year. Like, that's amazing. That's an asset. That's like a bank account, you know?
Yeah.
And so they can be jokes. They can be ideas for books. They can be ideas for projects, anything. So that if I'm ever given some kind of opportunity to do something, I have a bank of things that I can sift through, and I'm not scrambling at the last second, you know, to put together a packet, or, you know, somebody needs a screenplay idea. Because stuff like that happens in the comedy business, where you meet somebody and they're like, oh, I got a buddy at a development company. They're looking for a screenplay about hamsters. You know, it's like, oh, well, out of my 3,650 ideas, I happen to have a screenplay idea about a hamster. It's gonna be great. So I like being in that position.
Funny thing you say things about hamster, because I've got a whole 9-minute bit that I do about hamster.
That is
stepdaughter.
I did not know that.
It's one of my biggest. It's like one of my big closure things when I do my show. It's actually, it slowly has built a thing. It went from a 5-minute thing to a set. Now it's a 9-minute thing in my sets that I close with when I do shows.
Hamsters are funny. They're one of the inherently funny things.
They are.
With you, people being inspired by you, who inspired you?
Oh, that's a good question. So when I was coming up, the thing that inspired me the most was comedy that I thought was terrible. Comedy that really sucked. I was a big fan of Steve Martin, but he put out a book in the late 70s called Cruel Shoes that I got and read voraciously, and I was shocked by how bad it was. I thought, Steve Martin's a genius. How did he write a bad book? And I was looking at it thinking, well, I could write a better book than this. And that inspires me. That lights a fire under me. And any kind of like sitcom, you know, that's bad and has, you know, fake laugh track or whatever, that inspires me, because I feel like, well, if they can do it, surely I can succeed at that. And so that was a real motivator for me. Looking back, there definitely were also some positive influences, people who I really worshiped, like Steve Martin. David Letterman was one. Andy Kaufman was another one. Mad Magazine was huge for me. And Sesame Street was huge going back. What a great show for kids. Like, they structured those little segments as little comedy bits, like vaudeville comedy bits. And they would even do like these vaudeville cliches, like the shave and a haircut music and just obvious punchlines and stuff. So they taught me like basic comedy structure. And Laurel and Hardy, I was big with them, the Little Rascals, you know. So, and also a big one, I think, was Jay Leno, which I didn't realize at the time. He would show up on David Letterman's show. And at the time, in the early 80s, he was the comedian's comedian. He was the comedian everyone loved and respected. He was the most successful of any of the road comics. And he would hold he'd sort of hold the floor in green rooms and give people his tips for how to be successful at comedy. But when he went on Letterman, he would kill every time. And his material was so funny, and it was just perfectly targeted to me and my demographic audience, which was, you know, high school, early college. His material was just gold. And I went to see him perform, and he basically did all the material I'd seen him do on Letterman. Wasn't like nowadays where you do a separate 5 minutes to go on a show. It was his act. That was his act. And he did it for years. But it was so funny and so good. And then when he got to Tonight Show and started doing sort of, you know, more milquetoast comedy for old people, a lot of people were saying, ah, Jay Leno's lost it or whatever. But I knew what was going on. I knew that Jay Leno is such a consummate professional. He basically was doing college humor for Letterman. But when he got the Tonight Show, he's like, oh, my audience now is boomers, so I'm going to do boomer humor. Yeah. And they loved him. You know, he's that good. So, like, there's so many lessons to be learned from Jay Leno. He's really the master, the comedy writing master and performing master. Like, brilliant writer, brilliant performer. And, you know, there obviously were so many more other than that. But I think those are the main ones for me. The Simpsons was a good one too, because they actually debuted the same year that The Onion debuted. And we've had this like parallel track, and they get credit for predicting the future. The Onion gets credit for predicting the future sometimes, not as much as The Simpsons. But we've had this really interesting parallel track where we've done satire and news parody in print, and they've done animated comedy on TV. And they've been super influential. The Onion has been super, super influential. And, you know, I feel like almost a kinship with them.
Right.
But also, you know, every week we would watch The Simpsons on Sunday night at the Onion office when we were putting the paper to bed. The newsprint publication would go to the press Sunday night. And invariably, every time, there would be some joke on The Simpsons that was really similar to a joke in The Onion. And I knew that The Onion would come out the following Wednesday and everybody would think we stole it from The Simpsons. So we would have to scrap that joke and rewrite a joke because we didn't even want the appearance of stealing from them.
That sucks.
It's awful. Yeah.
It's like when you write a joke, you go, oh, this is a good joke. I'm going to use this. And then all of a sudden you run across somebody with a similar joke right before you go up. You're like, are you kidding me?
Oh, it's the worst. Yeah. When somebody opens for you and does half your act, you know, but the problem with, in the old days was you couldn't know if someone had done the joke. There was no access. Now you can Google it. That's super, super handy. But we would used to get called out all the time for stealing people's jokes. Michael Moore once called me at the Onion office fuming because we had supposedly stolen a joke from one of his comedy books. He used to write comedy books.
Yep.
And I was like, dude, I haven't read the book. Apologies. I'm sure it's funny, but you know, great minds think alike. And it was really funny because after that, he sent me an email like, oh, yeah, dude, everything's okay. You're doing great work.
Who
you
didn't know? He call, like, and, call and complain to? I said, who didn't he call and complain to?
Yeah, no, that was his thing, I think.
Yeah. That's hilarious. Oh, that's funny. But that's the difference in, you know, then to now, and now you can Google like, has anybody done this? Is that me? But then again, comedy, there's not, I mean, we all live the same life. We just got the different take. It's like Chappelle says, how interesting are you? If that comedian is interesting, has a different interesting, you know, spin, that's who I want to listen to. It could be about the same thing because we all do the same things. What is your take? What is your spin? What is your uniqueness?
Right. Yeah. Uniqueness is really the commodity in comedy. And so it's one of the things I tell my students is you have to be doing something different, you know, reinvent whatever you're doing, be totally different from everybody. Cause the impulse that most people have is to be like other people. Oh, this kind of thing is working in stand-up now. I'll do that. And that's really the opposite of the way you want to go.
And that's when you walk into a room and everybody, and there's 15 comics doing all weed jokes. You're like, okay, enough. Can we have a different somebody? And then you go up there and do something totally different. And they're like, everybody's like, oh, this is amazing.
Exactly. It can be lonely, you know, when you're doing something different at first, because people might be confused. But it's important to stick with that.
But at the end of the day,
like you said, you know, finding your own, you know, and going with it.
But then in the day, it's a lonely business. You are by yourself. You are your own solo running machine. You know, you can have friends, but you are your own entity.
Yeah. And there's no lonelier place than being on stage under the lights. You know, it seems like you're in a crowd of people laughing at you, but you're completely alone. And that's actually somewhat of a comfort to me. It's one of the reasons I like doing it because I'm an introvert. I don't like being in a parties and I don't like hanging out with people. I prefer to never leave my house. So if I can go to a place like that and just be alone on stage talking to myself, that's fine. You know?
It's so funny how many people say they're an introvert but end up being good in comedy and doing comedy regularly. It's like I've got friends that way. They're just to get them to come over and hang out and write, it's like pulling teeth. But if there's a show, we're sitting there and I'm like, I can't get you out of the house.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe some people are introverts. I don't know anyone as introverted as me. I'm practically a recluse, practically a hermit. And I, you know, yeah, there are some comedians like that who I think of Steve Martin, Andy Kaufman, two of my heroes, Robin Williams, another one, you know, super quiet and kept to themselves when they weren't on stage. And I don't know about them, but for me, comedy became early on in life a thing that I did in order to connect with people and have community. Because, you know, humans are social animals. Even the introverts and the recluses do need other people, but they find these weird alternate ways to be with people. So like me, I was a shy kid and I didn't make friends easily and was kind of awkward and uncomfortable in social groups. So I learned early on that if I wrote funny things or drew funny pictures and showed it to people, they would laugh. And that felt like a connection to me. So that's the lane that I found for myself and kept doing that. And it's now it's like I'm maladapted to that. That's how I interact with people in the most natural way. So if I go to a dinner party, I'm incredibly uncomfortable. It's not my thing, you know?
Right. Oh yeah. Let me tie in a reverse here for a say, because you had brought something up earlier and we kind of went down this path, but about writing. I'm a horrible writer. Writing anything as like a book or anything, I am a horrible writer. But being here where we are and where Jody and I live and being on the other side in the movie and TV world as well, working in that when I'm not doing comedy, and Jody does that when he gets booked on a lot of different things as a stunt guy and all that. He and I both had the same conversation. They are desperately pounding their fists for stuff, for new writing, new stuff, no matter what. And Hollywood, I mean, I've been on sets of where we've been sitting there talking to producer, like, are you a writer too? And I was like, what? I know you do stand up, but do you write? I go, well, I write my own jokes. They go, no, do you write like scripts, books, anything else? And if you have something, will you submit it or give it somebody? Because they said, we are desperately looking for anything and everything. What do you say to your students, and are you seeing that as well? Because here, now that everything here is being filmed here, they're all here. They're like, we need stuff. We need new stuff. We're just regurgitating stuff because it makes money, but we're looking for new stuff.
Yeah, I think because of the rise of all these networks and all these streaming services, there's just more desperation for written material that's good. And so it is easier to break into TV now than it used to be. You know, when there were three networks, it was almost impossible. When there was cable TV, you had like, you know, 15 networks. It was a little easier. Now there's literally an innumerable amount of channels to get paid to write stuff for. So now the trick is finding those and submitting and finding out who's looking for stuff. But yeah, there's no shortage of venues. I think now agents are more useful than ever because they kind of have a sense of what the lay of the land is and can get your stuff in the right hands. So that's another good reason to do stand up and to be diversified. So you're doing other things, because if you're looking for work and you do stand up, but you don't do anything else, it's going to be harder to get an agent. But if you write and you do other things, an agent is going to know that you're serious about the craft and you're putting yourself out there, and they're going to see a future in you. You know, and agents, they're just birds, you know, they just like shiny things that move, you know? So if you're on the move, if you're a moving train, they want to get on it. And I've had a lot of comedian students say, well, I don't really want to work on a late night show. I just want to do my comedy. And I tell them, look, if you get an opportunity to write for any kind of show, take it, because it'll increase your platform. You'll meet new people. You'll network. You'll get more opportunities. It'll cross-pollinate. Your comedy will get better. Your writing will get better. So yeah, I'm sorry to hear you say you're a terrible writer, Andy, because honestly,
I'm working on it.
Good. Because if you're writing jokes for your comedy, you're a good writer. You know how to do it. Storytelling is harder. It's different than joke telling and joke writing. I find And I'm sure there are people who are better storytellers than joke tellers. So maybe it's not a universal, but for me, storytelling is harder than joke telling. So you got to get, you know, books about it and practice it. I think it was Mark Twain, great storyteller, who said that no one is a born storyteller. It's a skill like anything that you have to practice and master. But my God, what a valuable skill in this day and age, because for a long time in Hollywood, there was just a handful of people who were kind of guaranteed to know how to make a story work. There was John Lasseter, there was Steven Spielberg, there was James Cameron, you know, and a few writers whose names nobody knows. But now those people are coming out of the woodwork. They're self-publishing novels on Amazon, and they're parlaying that into being screenplay doctors, you know, and story doctors for Hollywood. There is an endless appetite for that type of work.
Right. Yeah, no, and you're exactly right. I am trying to work on that to get better. But even my wife's like, do you proofread your stuff? Because you're a horrible grammatically. Like, I know what I said in my head.
Yeah. See, I don't sweat that stuff. Like, you can get a proofreader to clean it up. But if you, the structure is the hard part, you know, the story structure, getting characters that people care about and all that sort of stuff. That's hard.
Yes, that is completely hard. I've got great ideas. I got all these ideas. It's just like, how do you do this? And then I know people who are great writers, like they can just go blah, 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 knock it all out. And once you tell it, I'm like, I hate you.
Yeah, it's an amazing skill. I've always been enamored of it. And I've tried to get better at it myself. Because I've mostly been writing jokes my whole life. I haven't been writing stories, you know, and I had the opportunity to write a few screenplays and sell those and TV pilots. And the more you do, the better you get at it. You work with other people who teach you things along the way. And like so many of the books behind me are how to write screenplay books, like how to tell a story, because I really had to put myself through a little school for that.
Right. Right. It's like anything. You've got to learn it from the ground up and figure it out. And
well, like you said, I mean, you're crappy at the beginning. You gotta perfect it.
I got to figure out how to take my attention and focus it, because I just get distracted. It's like, oh, shiny. Because then all of a sudden you're about something and you go left and you're like, oh, you get way off.
Have you tried Adderall?
No, I have not. I did when I used to play poker.
People swear by it. Writers use it a lot. They swear by it.
They do. You know, I don't know. My wife keeps saying, she goes, I think we need to put you on something, because you're at this point in your life. She goes, you get things done, but you have got to be like laser focused. And then if something happens, you go, shoo.
It's tough. There's so many distractions now. How can anybody stay focused? It's impossible. It's like, it's literally like there's porn. There's funny comedy shows. There's a new TV show debuting every day. It's like, my God, how can you stay focused on doing something that has some sort of long-term benefit? Humans weren't built for this.
No.
Humans are built for instant gratification. So if you have the option of either doom scrolling on TikTok or starting to write a screenplay, you're going to lose that battle 99.9% of the time. It's tough.
Oh, exactly. You're exactly right. I mean, there's so many distractions. It's ridiculous. Like I was telling Jody when we were in the green room and stuff before we went live here. And I was like, dude, I've got so much done today. He's like, what? I was like, I got a haircut at 9 o'clock. I washed my car. I got my truck cleaned out for the road trip. And then I just like, I've got 8 things done before the podcast.
You know, and I feel like that too. Like I try to be productive, but sometimes like you're working all day. You're like responding to emails. You aren't really doing anything. And then you suddenly, you lead with porn, but okay. LOL.
Okay,
thank you.
Man.
Porn is one of the things that exists in this world that did not exist. There was not easy access to it when I was growing up.
No.
And I don't know how the kids today are dealing with it. I really don't. But there are days when I have like a 5-hour block and I look back and it's like, oh my God, I didn't do anything. I did the laundry and I feel exhausted. How did that happen?
Yeah.
You know,
that's exactly what happened to me. You know, when in 2020, when everything, and then we're stuck here, and then I got stuck in these little holes, and now I am still trying to break the habits of getting in those little distraction holes of, you know, looking at TikToks or something. Like, I'm going to do a TikTok, create, like, I give myself a limit now. Like, you got 30 minutes to get on there, look, create something, post something, and get the heck off and move on.
That is a great strategy. There's this copywriter, Dan Kennedy, who started this trend a long time ago of setting alarm clocks at work. So when you've got a timer going, it really does help focus you. And sometimes when it goes off, you're in a zone and you can keep working, which is fine if you're like writing something. But for something like that, like posting on social media, like that timer goes off, stop, for God's sake, stop, you know.
Stop, put it down, get away from it.
Yeah.
It's so easy, but you're like, oh, I'm going to do some research and get some ideas for something. 2 hours later, you're like, what was I doing again?
Yeah, that's brutal. Happens to me all the time.
Exactly. It's so crazy just to get that focus. But you got it. But I find myself now that, because I've ran a business on my own as a independent sales guy, and I was very disciplined. Of course, we didn't have instant, you know, whatever on our phones to distract us up until now. But now I can run I used to be able to run a $2 million business off phone, which was amazing to me. That enthralls the fact that people can run $1 million business off a phone now. That's amazing. Awesome, but it can also be a detriment, but also an asset and a tool if you use it right and correctly. And now I'm making myself lists. Like I said, all right, I got to do this and this. I'm going to give myself 30 minutes. I'm going to give myself an hour to do this. And I'm having to get way more structured than I used to on paper because of the amount of distractions there are. Not because I can't do it. It's the amount of distractions there are.
Yeah, I remember when we were starting up the Onion, there was no internet. And so we would go down to the Onion office and we would just work on the Onion and there was no distraction. At one point, somebody brought in a video game that could play on the Onion's office computers. They were like all early model Apple computers and it was called Crystal Quest. And it was a very addictive game and you had to like move this crystal from one side to the other, whatever. And then around that same time, Star Trek The Next Generation did an episode where a game came into the Enterprise and you attach it to your head. And it was the same thing. You like put the crystal in, and I'm sure they were inspired by Crystal Quest to do that. But in the episode, everyone got brain hacked and Wesley Crusher had to save the ship. A very similar thing happened at the Onion because I came in one night to work. We always came in, you know, at odd hours to work. 2 a.m, there's like 3 guys playing this game on the computer. And it looked like an opium den in the office. So I was like, okay, we're banning this game from the office. No more game. And then a distraction that powerful didn't come along again until the internet. And when that started, I had to set up a whole office that did not have internet access just so you could go in there and work and not get distracted with the internet. Now, of course, like it's such a valuable tool. You need to be researching and you need to be using it and stuff. It would be impractical. And obviously you've got your phone. You didn't even have phones then with internet. You just had computers. So we really have had to develop this new skill fast of how to be productive and still deal with all these distractions.
Oh, 100%.
Hats off to anyone who's doing well with that. Like it's not easy.
No, it's not. It's not easy. You've got to literally block, you know, and my wife, in her business, they have separate computers from their personal stuff. So a lot of companies are like, we're just giving you your own computer that we control that we have. So you don't, any issues or distractions on your personal and all that. Plus you don't want your personal. Anyways, we won't go down that rabbit hole because we're getting close to the end of our time anyways. Scott, it's been great having you on the podcast. I mean, we could go on for hours about different things, yeah. I think, but I know we've got a limited time with you, but I appreciate your time. Hey, tell everybody about your books, your classes, what you got going on, what you got coming up, promotions, anything, shows.
Sure. Thanks for asking. So yeah, if you go to howtowritefunny.com, you can get a ton of free resources for how to get better at writing comedy, how to succeed in the comedy business. And if you want to go deeper with me, you can get the books. The How to Write Funny book series is on Amazon. There it is. And I've got courses you can take. And as part of those courses, you get to be in a writer's room with me where we critique each other's work and we serve as a feedback group. It's a great group of comedians that gets together about three times a month. That's been super helpful in the pandemic and super helpful now still to have your own writer's room. And so I have my own comedy podcast called Scott Dickers Around, where I just try to be funny for about 10 minutes a week. It's where I try out new material and I make an occasional animated cartoon and do other fun stuff. And what else? You know, Google me. Even if you spell my name wrong, I'll show up in the Google. Google knows me now.
You are easily findable on Google. You were very easy.
There's one other guy in Maryland who has the name Scott Dickers, and he's the only other one. And I think he works in banking or insurance or something. So there's no danger of you getting the wrong guy. And you'll find all my social media and all the stuff and anything you might be interested in.
Great. Thanks. Yes. And I will link all of that stuff on when we put this on our 17 platforms as well, Facebook, YouTube as well, so that your links are there. They'll be down at the bottom or in the bios. So just look for that stuff. Jody, what do you got going on? What you got coming up? You're back. You're unbanned from TikTok. What's going on? What's happening now?
That's great.
Yeah, we doing the cameos. That's got it back going. Got the 1.9 back active. So, yeah.
How many cameos are we doing now a week? Because you were at 254, oh, almost 300. Where are we at now?
I had to put a limit.
Wait, you did 300 cameos in a week?
Yes. Cameo actually called me because I've done the most of anybody that they've had.
That's incredible.
A couple weeks ago.
That's correct.
So I had to put a limit, 100 of them a week, because it just got overwhelming.
Again, like we were talking about earlier, we didn't really dive into it, but with, you know, when Jody started TikTok, he was like, hey, man, I'm just trying to make some more money in a different area because I'm not getting booked as much as I was on some of the movies. And he said, I'm trying to make some money. And now here he is doing 300. Now he says he's got to put a limit at what.
Yeah. That's great. You got a lot of great problems, Jody. You know, too many followers on TikTok, too many cameos.
Well, like we talked about, it's a networking platform. You know, where do you want to go with it?
What's that?
I said it's like you said before, it's a networking platform. Totally. Where can you take it?
Yeah. It sounds like you've really done an amazing job leveraging that. So hats off to you.
Yes, he has. He's done an amazing job with it. It's been great to watch and just it's been exciting. So I have nothing but the most respect because he got exactly what he wanted. but that's it for the Fat with the World podcast. I got some shows coming up this week. I'll be in Bethlehem, Georgia tomorrow night for the second anniversary of Jittery Joe's comedy. They've been doing comedy there for 2 years. I'm on the anniversary show, and then I will be going to Houma, Louisiana Saturday night to do a show out there, and then back here Sunday in Atlanta for the Atlanta Comedy Awards, where I'm nominated for Funniest Clean Comic in Atlanta. I'll be performing and hopefully maybe taking a trophy or not. It's been just fun being a part of it. It's been a great show. Scott, thanks for coming on. Thanks for being here, brother.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, guys. A lot of fun.
Yeah, love to have it back anytime. If you got something coming up and talk some more on some different topics, you're welcome back anytime. Love to get you back here. Other than that, everybody, have a great week. Check us out on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and our other 16 platforms out there. You can look, find us, Fat Thor Podcast. You know where we are. Find Jody, find Scott, find me. We're around. We're doing our thing. We'll see you later. Thanks, everybody.
Okay, everybody.